Hello and welcome to the Smorgasbord of Podcast. I'm your usual host, Dave Swan, but not today. This episode, we have a very special interview conducted by our own South Australian correspondent, Jimmy Ellis, who talks with Peter Owen from the Wilderness Society. Peter also happens to be a Victor Harbour resident and concerned South Australian, concerned with the goings-on in the Great Australian Bight. What exactly am I referring to? If you haven't yet caught our latest edition of Smorgasborder, what I'm referring to is that permission has been granted for a company to perform seismic testing for oil prior to offshore drilling in one of our most pristine marine environments, the Great Australian Bight. It's pure lunacy. If something was to go wrong, the scale of disaster would make Deepwater Horizon look like a drop in the ocean. The magnitude of the disaster and who and what would be affected is truly frightening. On a happier note, this episode of our Smorgasbord podcast is brought to you by the organisers of the Byron Bay Surf Festival, which is on next week from Wednesday the 20th of Feb through to Sunday the 24th. Heaps of live music, photo exhibits, interviews. This year in the Surf Legends Lounge, Vaughan Blakey has a Q&A session with Rasta, Oki, Taylor Steele and Dick Hull. It is going to be a cracker. That's on the Thursday at the Byron Community Centre from 7 p.m. Then there's Surf Art Market. There's further chats with Steph Gilmore, Lisa Anderson, art shows, surf expression sessions, loads of boards, gear. Simply put, you just got to get there. Starting from next Wednesday, Feb 20, the Byron Bay Surf Festival. Anyhow, on with the show. Enjoy our own Jimmy Ellis chat about our fight for the bite.
This is Jimmy Ellis, the Smorgasborder. We are sitting here tonight with Peter Owen from the Wilderness Society of South Australia. G'day, Peter. How's it going there?
Yeah, good, mate. Yeah.
Very good. Very good. So some of you guys may know that there's something in South Australia that has pricked up a few ears of people involved in the coast, and particularly in our scene of surfing. And I remember that myself, several years ago, I was sitting out in a campground at Cactus, and I heard about some helicopters. We were doing some buzzing over all of this area where we've never seen helicopters before. And we started talking about it, and this is probably like 3 or 4 years ago. And then we started to hear over the few years about this fight for the bite, the Great Australian Bite. We started to hear about oil exploration, and I guess it started to get a bit concerning. But Peter's here to share with us a bit about some of the sequence of the story, and you know, when did it start for you, Peter? When did you first sort of have your ear to the ground and hear about it, and what did you hear, and when was it?
Well, I'll probably take things back more than a decade now, because we've been working to protect this remarkable place, the Great Australian Bight, for a long time. It started with our work to get wilderness protection for the Nullarbor and the Bunda Cliffs of the Great Australian Bight. And they were proclaimed under the Wilderness Protection Act in South Australia a few years back, but that was a campaign that took the best part of a decade. And during that period, we're also working to protect, under the Wilderness Protection Act as well, all of the offshore islands right throughout the Great Australian Bight and the marine environment, both at a state and federal level, because the Bight's is obviously a very large place.
Yeah.
And part of the Bight's under the South Australian jurisdiction, and part of it is the Commonwealth jurisdiction. So we've worked with both state governments and federal governments to get marine protection right through the area, and the Bight is now covered in marine parks, which highlights the, you know, the ecological importance of this place. The Bight is spectacular. You know, it's a magnificent marine wilderness area. But anyway, so at the end of a lot of that work, which created huge land and sea connected protected areas, you know, almost unparalleled globally, the oil industry suddenly appeared on the scene. So this is going back about 5 or so years now. Leases were issued under the Rudd Labor government some years back, and then oil companies started bidding for the leases, And suddenly there was a push to open up the Great Australian Bight to the oil industry. The first proponent was a company called BP. They were obviously the company that caused a huge disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. They were awarded a lease literally 6 months or so after that disaster there. So, you know, work that out. Worst environmental disaster happening on one side of the planet to a particular company who at the same time is being awarded leases in the pristine marine wilderness of the Great Australian Bight.
So this is 2010?
Yeah, it's about that. So we're going back, you know, 8 or 9 years now. But, you know, that's some of the history, I guess. And so we realised then that, you know, we were going to have to, you know, be part of a huge campaign to stop this, because obviously this was seen as a what's called a frontier fossil fuel basin by the oil industry. You know, they were pushing into a marine wilderness area, an area that they hadn't really gone before, certainly in terms of the depths that they're talking about drilling now. And so we knew you know, there was obviously going to be a significant push, and that we were going to have to create, you know, and build awareness in the community about what was being proposed, and you know, and build a huge campaign to stop this. And I guess the last 5 or 6 years have you know, seen that process emerge.
And the when we wrote the article for Smorgasborder, one of the big bits that really alarmed me was I looked at some of the weather forecasts for around the world, and I looked at, you know, I looked at 20 spots in the Gulf of Mexico, and I got, you know, a 20 to 30 knot wind rating. And I matched that up with the swell forecast for the same day. And you probably saw in the article that those swell forecasts were all under 1 metre with a 30 knot wind. And that's in the Gulf of Mexico, which is, you know, in South Australia, could we compare that to the, you know, the Gulf of Adelaide, you know? Not many ways, but a 30 knot wind in the Great Australian Bight, you probably saw, like, I think I got a 6 to 8 to 10 metre swell. And from a surfing, a fishing perspective, that frightens us. We just, you know, it hasn't been done before. You know, I don't think it has it?
No, without doubt, the Bight is one of the roughest places on this planet. There's a fantastic film called Operation Jeddah that was shot a couple of years ago in the Bight, and the purpose of that, it was the Great Australian Bight Alliance, it was the Wilderness Society, it was Sea Shepherd. We had an expedition out into the Bight so we could bring to the world what was at stake. And there's some pretty rough waves at one point in that film, but they're quite small in comparison to what you're talking about and what can happen in the Bight. The Bight... the severity of the conditions in the Bight are almost unparalleled. And if you compare what's, I guess, the Gulf of Mexico situation, that was in the middle of a big, relatively sheltered gulf. It was in the middle of probably the most industrialised places on the planet. And it still took them 3 months to shut that, that blowout down. How are they ever going to deal with a disaster like that in the Great Australian Bight? The Bight is a marine wilderness area and one of the most remote, one of the roughest, one of the deepest places on the planet. So what is being proposed here by and encouraged by irresponsible Australian governments, irresponsible, you know, oil and gas advocates, and I'd go as far as to say, you know, irresponsible oil companies, really must be stopped. I mean, these are risks on a scale that we can't afford to take.
And the modelling that you've seen, that I guess you guys commissioned a few years back, you know, that, what did it show? You know, because we've got people that are listening to this that are not in Australia. They, you know, roughly know the south coast of Australia, and they know where Tasmania is. But, you know, can you paint a picture for them about if there was an oil spill, what could happen over a month or two to Australia, to the coast, to Antarctica? What could happen?
When we were, I guess, going through the process of trying to stop and encourage BP to withdraw their drilling plans, they were the first of the companies, they were going through what's called the consultation, community consultation, which is required as part of the process for getting an approval by the Australian regulator, who decides on whether they get an approval, obviously.
Yeah.
So they were doing this required consultation, and we were asking for them to show us the magnitude of the risk and show us how they're going to then deal with that risk. So the magnitude of the risk is obviously the oil spill modelling.
Yeah.
You know, what's possible here?
Yeah.
And that was not forthcoming. And we're also obviously asking for, you know, and then how are you going to deal with that, which is called their oil pollution emergency planning. So they were the two parts of their proposal that they wouldn't make public. And so we were saying, look, the only things the community really wants to know, you won't make public in what you're calling the community consultation. So in the end, we were left with no alternative but to commission independent oil spill modelling so we could actually help inform a very concerned Southern Australian community of the magnitude of the risk that was essentially being enforced upon them at that point.
And who did you get to do that? Was it?
Well, it was some specialist modellers who were in New Zealand at the time. But they work all over the world. We had to find people that could not be questioned, that were of a very high standard. And for a small community group, you know, that cost a lot of money. But it was well worth the investment because once that modelling was released publicly, it helped very, very clearly and visually show the magnitude of the risk. And, you know, it showed that there was the potential for oil to be found in areas, you know, potentially right across... from WA, across the Bight through Bass Strait, so you know the magnitude of what's at stake here is something I don't think really seen before in Australia. I mean, are we willing to put our Southern Australian coastline at risk? You know, that's the question. Who in their right mind would be advocating for something with that magnitude of risk, even if the chances of a blowout are low, if the consequences of a blowout are catastrophic, the risk is high.
The risk
is very high.
So,
in this day and age, we're living in a time where every night you turn the TV on, there's a flood, or there's a fire, or there's hurricanes, or there's, you know, climate change is happening very fast.
Unforeseen events.
It's happening very fast. We know we've got to be transitioning out of the fossil fuel industry, not expanding it on an almost unprecedented scale. You know, I mean, even if the risk to that marine environment and to the tourism industry, the fishing industry, you know, who combine probably employ well over 10,000 people and contribute between $1 and $2 billion a year to the Southern Australian economy. You know, all of the people that rely on that beautiful coastline, the surfing community, the boating community, not to mention it's a world-class marine wilderness area. Even if it was just that, you know, and not the climate situation as well, it would be a proposition that is just something that has to be stopped. But in 2019, to be pushing to massively expand the fossil fuel industry is simply not an option if, you know, our kids are going to have any chance of having a livable climate or going to the beach, you know. So, I mean, we don't have a choice here. No matter how you look at this proposal, it must be stopped. It's we're living in a strange point in history, and the Kookaburra is agreeing with us. The Kookaburras out there are saying, finally, someone is saying this.
It's extreme. That's quite an orchestra over there, isn't it? We're doing this podcast in the Adelaide Hills, and so we've got a few Aussie animals, creatures, birds, who are going really nuts at the moment. Hello. That was good. Hey, just back to the modelling, you know, if in terms of like the surfing community around the world, they've seen the modelling through Patagonia that's been in the media of different things. I've seen the modelling from Greenpeace that's been, you know, Facebook and that sort of stuff. And, you know, you know more about this than anyone. I'm guessing they've just sort of interpreted your different scale models that you guys have done, or have they done their own? I mean, I'm thinking it's from one of the models that you guys must have commissioned years ago.
Yeah, I assume so.
Yeah.
Certainly some of the imagery looks like the original modelling that we did.
Yeah.
And that's great. You know, the models are getting out there. I know Patagonia had an amazing T-shirt, and I think they've still got it, of some of the images from the oil spill modelling. And, you know, they're doing fantastic work.
So it's just good how, you know, obviously someone that, you know, in South Australia 20 years ago has been donating to you guys, you guys have obviously, you don't go out and spend the kind of money that you need to with a scientific team to do the modelling every day. You've got to save for that thing.
And
it's not just being used by you guys, it's being really propelled. And we've heard of, you know, Patagonia going to like 7 countries in the last 6 months and showing films and bringing awareness and sending their surfers to a couple of continents over Christmas and New Year's to do things. So I guess I'm kind of connecting the dots too, and of, you know, the stuff that they're talking about, the stuff they're showing, and it is connecting people to this issue that that weren't connected a month ago, connected 6 months ago, and you know, and the surfing community around Australia is starting to talk about this, and you know, from an environmentalist like yourself, What is that? Once you hear that the surfing community is sort of standing up and starting to talk about it, how does that make you feel, and how does it make your team feel, and has it made you do things differently?
Look, it's always amazing, I think, when an issue that you know, you've been working on for a long time is suddenly embraced by lots of other people. I mean, the beach has been a very important part of my life since I was a kid. You know, I was born at Victor Harbour, down on the beach, you know, grew up on the banks of the Coorong. You know, the coastal environment is so important. The, you know, the connection with the marine environment, the connection with the surfing community. You know, we're all part of that. It is amazing when something reaches a groundswell where it's just, you know, that connection that unites us all, and everyone's standing together. I mean, that was one of the reasons we knew this was going to have to be a huge effort to protect the bite. You know, we're up against some very, very powerful companies, and that's you know, back a few years ago, the Wilderness Society obviously was working on the issue, and so was Sea Shepherd in Australia, and a number of other smaller groups across the coastline here, and that's in part why we launched the Great Australian Bite Alliance. It was to create a platform, essentially, for everyone to stand together, you know, in opposition to this proposal that was just not in the interests of this part of the world.
Yeah.
And since that time, you know, the Bite Alliance has grown and grown, and you know, like you say, groups like Patagonia are now members of the Bite Alliance. I remember it was quite amazing when the Bob Brown Foundation joined the alliance. That was just before we shot you know, the film Jeddah and the Great Australian Bite, and Bob was on that journey. You know, Bob Brown, one of the most significant, you know, figures environmentally in the world, probably. But to have so many people now, you know, standing with us. You know, the surfing community is an amazing network of people right across the world, and you can see it happening. Some of the most magnificent surf breaks anywhere are across southern Australia. You know, so it's important that we protect them.
Held surf breaks.
Yes.
As you know, and you're right. And, you know, in terms of the platform for the Great Australian Bite Alliance, you know, how many people first stood that first day talking about it when this idea was launched? And I mean, we know the figures now, but, you know, was there just 4 or 5 of you in a room when you sort of came up with this idea? And you know, how did that first day go with the Alliance?
Well, I can remember we we had a little press conference down at Port Adelaide.
Beginning
of 2016. Beginning of 2016. So we broke for Christmas and came back, and I can remember discussing before we all broke for Christmas, we're going to launch the Alliance to start the new year, and we were going to create this platform to encourage people to come and stand together. Mm. It was launched on a quite a nice sunny morning down near the Port Adelaide Lighthouse. And the media came down, and it was a good morning. And it was an empowering morning, and it's just grown and grown since then. I think that's one of the real secrets. I mean, an alliance of people standing together, supporting each other, having each other's back. In the face of adversity, really, that's what we were talking about here, is what it takes. And we've got some huge challenges, looking forward, protecting the bite and stopping, the expansion of the fossil fuel industry into this area is a critical line in the sand moment for our part of the world. I guess having built, being involved in, building the alliance and seeing how effective that's been and how it's empowered and united so many people from different walks of life. I think there's something in that for, all of the Southern Australian communities as we move forward, even beyond just the bite issue. I'd hope that we can protect the bite this year. I really do. But then it would, imagine keeping some of those networks together and moving and starting to think about other issues that, need to be addressed. I mean, there's a lot of power in the community standing as one, standing together.
Last year when I was, doing some holiday reading and some holiday surfing and travelling down in Port Ferry, down in Hobart, looking at these Fight for the Bite stickers on people's cars, on their electric bikes, on walking down a ship's stern. One of the guys had it on his board, big old Don't Surf, Fight for the Bite stickers. In the most remote places, we're seeing these, Fight for the Bite stickers. I got a photo the other day from Kalbarri in Nauru. There's some guys with some boards with their Fight for the Bite interpretation, their own deal on their stickers. Then you start to look at, this, the word's got out, but there's councils. How many councils are, obviously their electorate are saying something to the councils. How many councils are concerned about this issue?
To date, councils are moving all the time. As we speak, there's 15 councils across Southern Australia that have passed resolutions, raising serious concern with what's being proposed in the bite. I think there's 12 in South Australia, and I think there's 3 now, and possibly more across the Surf Coast in Victoria. And that's powerful, because what actually is happening is that the most connected level of government to the community and the genuine concerns and feelings of the community are actually standing up and saying, these are serious issues, this is the view of our community, and we're going to step up and do our job. Our job actually is to represent those communities. And what we're actually seeing is, I think for a long time now, the state and federal levels of government have actually forgotten what their job is. Their job is to represent the interests of the people that live in the electorates that they go into the state or the Commonwealth Parliament to represent.
Those 20,000 people, that's their electorate.
That is their electorate. How can a parliamentarian in South Australia or federally not have a view on the Great Australian Bite when their community is saying, we don't want this? And what's actually happened? So there's been this void created. Because it's, in some ways, state and federal mainstream political parties are just off with the fossil fuel industry, and state government is actually stepping up and filling that void and actually carrying out the role that responsible government is supposed to do, and that is represent the interests of the people they're supposed to be representing. State government is stepping up and taking the lead on this, and that, I think, that's a very significant development development in Australian politics at the moment. You know, 15 councils across southern Australia, probably representing somewhere between, you know, 600,000-800,000 people now. That's a big thing. You know, we haven't really seen that type of thing before. We've got local government saying to state government and federal government, we disagree with you.
So, like, geographically, you know, the councils, you know, we think about the WA and SA border, which don't have a council on the Nullarbor. The Bundakus don't have a council till they get to about Ceduna when the councils start, if we're going from west to east. The Ceduna council, they're not happy about this overall, or they've got some mixed feelings, or how are they?
Well, Ceduna, I don't think has passed a resolution.
Are they talking about the issue?
There's certainly there's a lot of concern in the Ceduna community. But they haven't you know, passed a resolution on the issue to date, to the best of my knowledge. Certainly Port Lincoln has. I know Elliston has. And then as you come closer to the city, I mean, you know, most of the Fleurieu Peninsula, you know, Victor Harvey, Ankalilla, Alexandrina, and a lot of the big metropolitan councils up through Adelaide, it's, you know, many of them have passed very strong resolutions now. You know, resolutions that are very clear. You know, it is our job to represent the interests of the people in our council area, and we don't believe that this is in their interests. Now, that's the job that state and federal governments are supposed to be doing for the people of this country as well. So the obvious question is, what's going on? Something's amiss here. Why are the councils, you know, having to step up and deal with this? And, I mean, I'd suggest it's probably because they're very close to the sentiment of the community. They're the most grassroots governance layer that we have in Australia. And they're genuinely listening to their communities. And I guess state and federal government are a bit more detached, but and state and federal governments are often, I suppose, compromised by other issues, which is concerning.
And there's a bit of talk about, you know, obviously lots of jobs for South Australia, and it, I guess, on the first, you know, you hear of that, and you think, oh, that's a good thing. Obviously, jobs are good. A bit of, you know, discussion we had with some guys that worked in the oil industry in Western Australia previously, and, you know, who were servers, and that also worked in Texas and the Middle East. And we asked them, you know, like, if you were going to be involved in, you know, an oil rig in the Bight, you know, who would you pick as your team? You know, you know, would you train people up, you know, as an apprentice? And they just said flat out, you know, this is the riskiest thing that's ever been proposed. We would fly in the best people from Texas. We'd fly in the best people from the United Arab Emirates that had decades of experience. And that they just said, you know, categorically, this, the workforce, you know, South Australians, you know, we'd like to think that, you know, that you could get some work out of this, but the reality would be that, you know, this is extremely delicate, you know, sort of stuff. And, you know, they didn't seem to think that the local towns of surfers and fishermen and families on the West Coast, would have much to benefit in terms of the work that was going on out there. But have you heard anything? Have you, over the years of following the issue, is that would that match up with what you've heard? Or
yeah, most definitely. I remember when BP, again going back a few years now, when BP were pushing for an environment approval to carry out their drilling. One of their submissions to the regulator made it fairly clear that the job opportunities at this point in the process, I think they used the word, are negligible. And this was in their own submission.
To the NOPSEMA or whatever.
To the regulator. I mean, I vividly remember reading it and thinking, I mean, you know, there's these people, there's some people out in the community suggesting these are this boom time and there's going to be jobs and this and that. I mean, the proponent themselves was saying that job opportunities at that point were negligible. And, I mean, it's... I mean, you're right. I mean, I think it's fairly obvious that this is highly specialised work. It's, you know, hundreds of kilometres off the coast. People are going to be flown in, experts from all over the world where they can get them. You know, this is not going to be providing jobs for people that may be looking for work in regional Australia. But what it is doing is putting at risk real jobs right across regional Australia. Real jobs, like we said before, in the fishing industry, the tourism industry, and, you know, those two sectors employ, you know, well over 10,000 full-time equivalent positions in southern Australia. So what this is doing is putting that at risk.
Yeah, we saw the letter from, is it the Oyster Growers and the Mollusk Associations to, I guess they were open letters to the press and to the government talking about their industry was extremely concerned. And I think some of the lobster areas are really concerned from what we talked to the local fishermen about, not only if there was an event with oil, but they're actually more worried about the seismic testing that's going on. And maybe you can have a chat to us about what you know about the modelling, the 2D and the 3D modelling and the seismic testing, and, you know, what's involved, you know, ecologically, what happens out there, the noises and the systems and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so, I mean, for a few years now there's been seismic testing companies trying to get approval to essentially blast huge amounts of noise right through the water column in the Great Australian Bight. So what they have is a large ship towing a vast array of cables which set off explosions and blast noise right down, kilometres down through the water column, and then, you know, vast distances into the seabed, and they try and gather data in terms of what oil resources might be down in the seabed. But of course, when you think about what it is that they're doing, blasting massive amounts of noise through the water column is obviously terrorising all of the animals that live in that water column. And, you know, there's a lot of scientific research now coming out to, you know, talking about the impacts on different species, be it lobster, phytoplankton, and of course all the whales and dolphins live in the bite. Now, you know, the Great Australian Bight is one of the most significant whale nurseries in the world, and to be approving seismic testing in the middle of a whale nursery, a whale sanctuary, you know, think about how whales communicate. They communicate through sound. They navigate through sound. You know, blasting 24/7 for months on end phenomenal amounts of noise through that water column is obviously going to have a very adverse effect on the animals that live there. So, you know, it's very disappointing that recently seismic testing was approved to be carried out in the Great Australian Bight this September, when we know there's a lot of whales and calves in the area, not to mention all of the other animals that live in the Great Australian Bight. I mean, it's been approved subject to a whole lot of conditions, and so we're still yet to see whether the proponent can actually meet those conditions. It's really to do with, you know, shutting the operation down with regard to the sighting of different whale species and things like that. And that in itself is obviously a very hard thing to do for a giant ship towing a vast array of cables behind it to be starting and stopping. And yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how this one pans out. But I mean, I guess the bottom line is the Great Australian Bight's a totally inappropriate place to be allowing that type of activity to happen. You know, this is a very significant whale nursery, and when they're considering allowing this seismic blasting to occur, is at the very time when we know the southern right whales and their calves are in the area. This was a species that was on the, you know, the verge of extinction, and is now recovering, and the numbers are increasing. Partly because of the pristine nature of the Great Australian Bight. This is their whale nursery. You know, it's totally irresponsible to be even considering these type of activities. The seismic activity cannot be allowed to proceed. And of course, you know, the exploration drilling proposals, which logically follow the seismic. The seismic works out where best to drill, and then they sink these drills. I mean, none of this exploration activity should be allowed to happen. You know, and fortunately, as I said before, BP have now pulled out of their plans to carry out the drilling. Chevron have pulled out of their plans. You know, we'd really encourage the two-third Norwegian government-owned company Equinor, which is the current company that's pushing for drilling approval in the Bight, we'd really encourage them to follow the responsible lead of both BP and Chevron over the last few years, who have actually decided to pull out. You know, the risks are too high. The Bight's a totally inappropriate place for this type of activity. It's a totally inappropriate time in history to be pushing to expand the fossil fuel industry. You know, we've got a serious climate issue. We're not going to have a livable climate into the future if we keep expanding the fossil fuel industry. We have to, you know, stop the expansion immediately and then work out how we're going to transition out of the existing industry to stabilise a lot of the climate issues. So, yeah, I mean, this is something that we have to achieve as a community. It's in some ways it's our responsibility to the planet to stop these proposals on our watch in our backyard, in our jurisdiction, if you like. You know, we hope, I suppose, that, you know, folks all over the world are doing similar things, and I know they are, you know, protecting their bit of beach, protecting their part of the planet. I mean, that's ultimately what we've all got to do. And, you know, this is where the alliance and things like that are so powerful. And communities right across the world are working like our communities are here across Southern Australia. And, yeah, but this is a big one here. I mean, what's being proposed in the Great Australian Bight is touted as one of the biggest frontier fossil fuel basin pushes on the planet. So, yeah, it's of international significance, and which is why it's very relevant to people all over the world.
It's interesting, when you were telling about that, I was thinking about when I was talking to Bunna Laurie, the Indigenous elder, from the Nullarbor, he's spent his life going up and down the Bunda Cliffs, and you know, maybe you can tell us a bit more, but he said to me, and I've spoken to a couple of people that were there that day, that he took a group of people and he invited anyone and everyone, and I'm not so sure that anyone involved in the oil exploration came within that day, but I think he would take them if they wanted to. And he took them, took people down to the cliffs, and he said, look, just watch me from here. And he went down, and he told me he didn't have to make very much noise to start communicating with the whales at all. Very little noise. And when you're talking about the seismic blasting, I was just thinking, like, humans would have the worst hearing in the ocean compared to all those other animals. And then I just thought of Bunna Laurie in the bottom of those cliffs. And then maybe you can tell us what happened that day, because, you know, you've talked to a lot of people that were there. You may have been there yourself, but, you know, was he yelling and screaming to bring the whales? What was he doing?
Well, the experience that I had was when we were on Operation Jeddara.
Yeah.
And we came into the head of the Bight, and I was obviously there with Jeff Hansen, the director of Sea Shepherd. I mean, it was Sea Shepherd's boat that led the charge on Operation Jeddara. I mean, the voyage, you know, was named after, essentially, you know, it was in the honour of Bunna, the white whale. It was in honour of Bunna. And so, you know, Jeff Hansen and I and Bob Brown was there, and Bunna, we stood there and watched, and Bunna walked to the edge of the cliffs, and he sat there, and he had some tapping sticks. And it was a real one of those life-changing experiences, certainly for me, watching someone who was clearly able to communicate with whales. And we were essentially greeted by a southern right whale with a small white calf. And it was right there. And the mother and the white calf went up and down for probably an hour or so, whilst Bunna sat on the edge of those cliffs. Yeah, he wasn't making a lot of noise. Yeah. At times he had some tapping sticks, I think, and he was signalling too, at different points. But something was happening there that was very significant. And yeah, it doesn't take a lot to work out that these are animals that are highly, highly intelligent. Mm. They communicate in very sophisticated ways. Mm. They've obviously got incredibly powerful hearing. Mm. And very sensory. Mm. The impacts of seismic activity, setting off explosions in their home, mm. that go 24/7 for months on end, mm. is a terrible thing to contemplate. Mm. Mm. And Bunner can articulate that brilliantly. Mm.
He told me that the whales are part of his story and his people's story, mm. you know, from that Ceduna region. Yeah. And he said that they're like our family, and when he said the whales, the story of the white whale was that they're a welcoming, happy, yeah. Culture which welcomes people, but he felt that if the story was disrupted practically by boats, by anyone,
yeah.
that they wouldn't just lose the whale, they'd lose their story.
Yes.
And he felt that their story was their connection. And he really explained it as though their connection was being pushed from them, yeah. in a way. Yeah. And I think he said the words... he said, "Equinor, you're not welcome." That's what he said to me, yeah. on the phone about a month ago. He said that Equinor's not welcome, and he pointed out that this is not an animal. This is his culture.
Yeah.
And when you saw him down there, he wasn't saying the words culture, but what was he saying to you? How did he explain it, or did he not explain it?
Oh. I've spent a fair bit of time with Bunner over the period, and a lot of the explanation's not in words. It's just in being there in the moment. Bunner does talk a lot about the significance of the whales and the white whale in particular, and being very important, to his people's stories and their dreaming. Mm. And it's very clearly something that's not separate from him.
Mm-hmm.
This is him, this is his, and the people of this region.
Mm-hmm.
and they're not separate from from the bite. Our communities, certainly Western communities, have become, unfortunately, I think, quite separated,
mm-hmm.
from the very things that make our lives possible.
Mm.
We're completely reliant on being part of an ecosystem,
mm.
yet we seem to have become separated from that reality. And I think that's part of what's causing a lot of the problems now. We've forgotten, mm. that connection. We can't survive unless we are actually in complete harmony with the rest of the ecosystem that we're a part of and that makes our life possible. Whereas when you see someone like Bunner out on the Nullarbor, you realise the importance of that connection and the context within which we need to live. Mm.
We've had a few phone calls from people in Ireland, in England, in New York, about they've heard about this issue there, and in Norway, and we heard that at the recess break in the United Nations in 2018,
yeah.
that they showed a video about seismic testing and what was being proposed in different areas regarding seismic testing affecting fishing areas, and mm. There's people are talking about this around, mm. the place. And I guess, coming to the end of this podcast, if people have, read the article in Smorgasbord or in issue 44, if they've heard about the fight for the bite, if they're interested, if you're if you're listening at the 25, 30 minute mark of the podcast and it interests you, what would you say and where would you point those people and could what could they do? Tell us about, you know, how small and how big the alliance is, because it's not 100 people anymore, is it? It's much bigger.
Yeah, well, the alliance is big. It's made up of people, groups, organisations, from across Australia and beyond now. Mm-hmm. But certainly the alliance has a web page. If you go www.fightforthebite.org.au, that will have regular updates over the next few months. I mean, one of the things we would encourage people to do is that Equinor, the company that is currently still in the Bight, pushing for exploration drilling. Obviously, we're encouraging them to follow the lead of BP and Chevron, who have pulled out. Mm-hmm. But there's still a company out there. It's 2/3 Norwegian government-owned company called Equinor. Mm-hmm. We would encourage people when they, assuming they release their application for drilling for public comment in the next mm-hmm. few weeks, to get submissions in and express your concern if you're concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Write to your local politician if you're in Australia, mm-hmm. and ask them, what their party's policy is on drilling in the Great Australian Bight, and express your concerns. We have a federal election coming up in Australia in May. It's a good opportunity. The major parties in this country need to represent the interests of the people in this country. This is not in the interests of the people across southern Australia. The risks associated with the proposed drilling in the Bight are huge. So this is our opportunity. And certainly over the next period, there'll be information on that Great Australian Bight Alliance, so at www.fightforthebite.org.au. There's opportunities for people to make submissions into the public comment process once Equinor released their plan for public comment. Mm. You can send submissions to the Oil and Gas Regulator in Australia, which is called NOPSEMA. It's an acronym, NOPSEMA.
Yeah.
Like I said, write to your local member and let them know that you're concerned about this. We have a federal election coming up. And more generally, get involved with any of the groups that are part of the alliance.
Yeah.
Obviously, I work for the Wilderness Society, but the alliance is a lot of groups. Yeah. The Wilderness Society, Sea Shepherd, and many others.
Yeah, and companies.
Even Smorgasborder. So, yeah, but also, obviously, the company that's pushing for the drilling rights, drilling approvals now, Equinor, they have a board.
Mm-hmm.
Write to Equinor as well. Mm-hmm. Write to their international board and say, look, what your company's proposing to do in Australia mm-hmm. is really concerning me.
Mm-hmm.
And talk through, the issues why. I mean, obviously, we've discussed some of it just over the podcast period here. Mm-hmm. We're talking about one of the most significant whale nurseries, one of the most significant marine wilderness areas in the world,
mm-hmm.
The Great Australian Bight is a magnificent place for so many reasons. Be it tourism, fishing, surfing, the amazing natural environment, the fact that this area sustains southern Australia.
Mm-hmm.
It's our lifestyles that are at stake here.
Mm-hmm. It's our way of life.
It's our way of life that's at stake here. Mm-hmm. And even just beyond the people of southern Australia, if this is allowed to go ahead, and if it goes ahead without necessarily an immediate catastrophic occurrence, such as a gigantic blowout or something, if it goes well in terms of what the oil industry would consider, the global climate ramifications are very significant. Mm. We carried out an assessment a couple of years ago. We commissioned a report which looked at just 2 of the 10 or so leases in the Bight at that point,
mm-hmm.
just to get a handle on, the size of the carbon bomb, essentially, that is sitting under the Bight. This is a carbon bomb. Releasing this into the atmosphere
mm-hmm.
is madness
mm-hmm.
at this point in history. We know that.
Mm-hmm.
And just two of those 10 or so leases, the estimations were something like about 100 times the state of South Australia's entire emissions. Just two of the 10 leases at the time in the Bight. I think there might be a couple more now. But, I mean, this starts to give us an idea of the actual... just the complete irresponsibility of what's being proposed here, given you know, the point in history that we're at. So it's not just about protecting an amazing place called the Great Australian Bight and protecting, you know, like you say, the way of life of the people and the entire, all the animals and plants, the ecosystems that live here. It's about actually a global push to protect our climate as well. So, you know, this can't happen. Yeah.
So, guys, if you'd like to, we'd like you to go to the fightforthebite.org.au. There's a statement of concern. You could be in New York or Singapore. You could be in London listening to this, and it's a website away. And it's 2 minutes to sign the statement of concern.
Yep, sign the statement of concern, and then we can also then directly communicate with you and give you opportunities to get involved at different key points over the next 6 months or so. I mean, obviously, we're really hoping that Equinor, the last of the big oil companies that are pushing on with this, that Equinor will follow the lead of BP and Chevron. Listen to the people of Southern Australia. I mean, what's interesting, Equinor, last year, one of their officials made it fairly clear at a public meeting that they won't push through opposition. Now, I'm not sure what 15 councils passing resolutions represents, but I would have thought that was massive opposition. And that's a complete lack of social license to do what's being proposed to do. So we would encourage Equinor to take note of that. Take note of what their own officials are saying. The community across Southern Australia don't want this. And, yeah, no matter where you are, whether you're part of the community in Southern Australia or across the world, this one is a line in the sand moment that affects us all. So, yeah.
It affects this. To finish, this clean water we can see. If you haven't seen issue 44 from Smorgasborder, you know, you guys look on. We're looking at the mag now, but we're looking at these photos on page 40 and 39 of the clearest water with the biggest sandstone cliffs.
Yeah.
And looking at a great white shark in the most pristine, deep, clear water, you know, amazing diving visibility. And this is the stuff that us very fortunate South Australians have grown up with, and that's why we're so concerned. So thank you, Peter, and we'll hear from you more again.
Thanks, James.
No worries, mate.
Well, thanks for tuning in, Smorgasborders. I hope you enjoyed Jimmy's chat with Peter Owen from the Wilderness Society about our fight for the bite. Thanks once again to podcast sponsors, the Byron Bay Surf Festival. Make sure you get along to this fantastic celebration of surf culture. Next Wednesday, Feb 20, through to the Sunday, Feb 24. That's all for now, Smorgasborders. Get wet. Check you next week.